Greetings and welcome to ID the Future. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting with Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture in Seattle, Washington. We have on the show with us today a very interesting guest here in the studio, Dr. Neil Steiner, who has a PhD in electrical engineering from Virginia Tech in Blacksburg, Virginia, and he works with the University of Southern California with a research division in Arlington, Virginia called the Information Sciences Institute, where he works on computer and engineering research. Well, it's a special privilege to have a computer science and electrical engineer with us on the show. We interview a lot of biologists, a lot of physicists, a lot of folks in the natural sciences, and it's not every day that we get the perspective of somebody from sort of the tech, engineering, and computer side of things to come and talk about this issue. So first off, I was wondering if you could perhaps explain for our listeners a little bit about the kind of research and work that you do.
Sure, I'd be happy to. The area that I work in is typically called configurable computing, and it has to do with chips that do not do just one specific kind of thing, but they can be configured to do many things. They can be changed in part or in whole while they're running, and in fact, they can change themselves under their own control. So you can have systems that become truly autonomous to some extent, at least.
Obviously, you're here on ID the Future because you're interested in the debate over intelligent design and Darwinian evolution. Before I get into your personal views on that topic, do you see any intersection between the issues that are at stake in the debate over Darwinian evolution and sort of the research and the kind of work that you do?
You know, to be honest, I don't see it so very strongly in the work that I do. I see little hints of it, but as an engineer, everything that I do depends on the underlying science. And so if the underlying science is problematic, because people have bad assumptions or just some premise that doesn't hold up, that harms me as an engineer because my stuff is not going to hold up when it needs to.
Yeah, I think engineers are very acutely aware of how, and especially computer scientists as well, how your assumptions will determine so much of the outcome of the work that you're doing. I did quite a bit of computer programming myself, and I remember the old dictum, garbage in, garbage out. I mean, the assumptions, the boundary conditions that you put into your program really are determinative of the output that you get.
I'd say that's one aspect of it, but it goes further than that because in the computer world, we can create simulations of anything we want and we can make up the rules. And as long as we don't write bad code, the software doesn't crash, so it'll do whatever we tell it. But as an engineer, my stuff has to work in the real world at the end of the day. And so that's where if I do build it on something that doesn't hold up, it doesn't matter how beautifully the model works, it's not going to work in real life.
Now, that's interesting. I can imagine how that would translate well into the debate over Darwinian evolution, where we see so many models being put forth for, say, how life arose or how this or that structure arose or evolved. But then do these really hold up in the real world? I'd love to talk to you a little bit about your own views. Maybe first off, what got you interested in the debate over evolution and intelligent design?
You know, I've been interested in the debate, if you want to call it that. I've been interested in this for a long time. I remember as a young kid, some teacher telling us that land animals had come out of the water or they had come from fish. And that seemed pretty contrary to what my understanding was. And I said, no, they didn't. That was my response to my friends. But a few years ago, I don't know, probably about 4 or 5 years ago, I was looking for a movie on Netflix and I found The Privileged Planet. And because I often like things about science and nature, and I thought, hey, maybe it's going to be interesting. And I saw that and I was so amazed by it. And I thought to myself, not only is this fascinating work, but I could show this to any of my colleagues, researchers, scientists, whoever, and not be the slightest bit embarrassed because it's legitimate stuff. I was amazed and I bought a bunch of copies and gave them to to my friends.
Well, that's great. I'm glad to hear. How did your friends receive it? We know people that have been
fired
for giving that.
Well,
video
you know, none of my friends unfriended me. So, no, the reception was good, but truly it's the kind of stuff that I could present to anybody and they might disagree with it, but they would have, I think, a hard time finding fault with the quality of the work that was done.
That's great. Where do you stand on evolution and intelligent design? Do you think that, say, a neo-Darwinian model of unguided evolutionary mechanisms, is that capable of producing the systems that we see at work in biology? Or what do you think about that?
I haven't seen evidence that that is supported in biology. I certainly have not seen evidence in my own field. There are certain things that we do where we use things like genetic algorithms or evolvable hardware. Those tools are useful, but even with a genetic algorithm, the developer, the programmer, or scientist, whoever, is still guiding the process. We're still providing the cost function that determines in what way the thing should proceed. The idea that something can emerge spontaneously and kind of end up in the state we have today with things like beauty and complexity and all that, that's very challenging to my mind. And so going back to some of the research that I've done in the past where I made a system that could change itself while it was running, that's very hard to do. I can't do that unguided. The system had to have a model of itself to understand how it could safely change itself. It's very difficult for me to imagine how biological systems would be able to evolve without having something like that.
I love talking to engineers because you guys have such a great understanding of how your boundary conditions have such a strong, powerful effect upon what you end up getting in the end. And I think a lot of biologists don't think in those terms. I mean, what boundary conditions would be necessary to produce the beauty and the complexity we see in the natural world? I assume that these are the kinds of questions that would be relevant to an engineering investigation.
I would think so. But also, if you think of how we as people do design, and as an engineer, I do think of myself as an intelligent designer, we build systems that can be very robust and very flexible and all that. But there's a difference between the way we build and the way nature builds. So we just have to put the thing up one time, and we do have to allow for whatever's necessary during the construction stage. That's different than living systems that are, at least during their growth period, which is very long and very complex, they're going through so many different changes. So for us, it's fairly challenging to make a one-time system that we design and build and works the way we want to. To make something that can grow, you know, so we're not just designing its final state, we're designing also the progression that it takes through growth. That's pretty complicated. I don't think we have any clue how to do that. I'm skeptical that that could be done.
Sometimes you'll hear an objection from ID critics who will say, well, we can't compare biological systems to human design technology or machines because biological systems, as you said, they grow, they reproduce. They're totally different than human design technology. My response has always been, okay, that's true, but we're talking about biological systems. They're actually more complex than human design systems. So if human design systems are designed, then what do we make of systems that are far more complex, and yet we're claiming those were not designed? I think flaws in the analogy actually point more strongly to design of biological systems rather than less strongly.
I have a friend, she's a retired nurse. So she began as an atheist, and when she was doing her nursing training and studying the heart, apparently there's 4 or 5 levels of backup to keep the thing going. And she was so amazed by it that her phrase for that was basically the cardiac cathedral. And she went from that to being an agnostic because she was saying, this didn't just happen. There has to be something behind it.
Now, you mentioned something earlier in our conversation, Dr. Steiner, that I think is very interesting. And that is, you have worked on genetic algorithms. And many ID the Future listeners, and certainly folks who follow the debate, are aware that we are often told that genetic algorithms are proof that you can, in fact, produce new information through unguided, blind, random processes, and you don't need intelligence, basically, to produce new information. And of course, the rejoinder from the ID camp and William Dembski and Robert Marks with their evolutionary informatics lab, they've made very similar arguments, I think, that when we look at these genetic algorithms and you study the algorithms up close, you actually can find and pinpoint in the code where the programmer is actually inserting information, using their intelligence to pre-program a certain outcome. And so really, they're not just producing something new, they're producing exactly what the programmer programmed them to produce through their intelligent programming abilities. I'd like to ask you maybe just a follow-up question on this point, since you have worked on these kinds of genetic algorithms before and you're familiar with them. How is it, in your experience, that the information or sort of the output that we see is actually pre-programmed into these genetic algorithms? Or do you think that maybe there is some new information that's actually produced through these genetic algorithms? What is your experience with this issue?
A genetic algorithm is a search function. So if you use Google, for instance, unless you click the I'm feeling lucky button, unless you do that, you came there because you're looking for something. A genetic algorithm can only help you find what you're looking for. And So it's true that you mutate or cross over or somehow perturb a population of elements that you're working with, but the way you decide which ones to kill off and which ones to keep comes from something called a cost function. And the developer has to encode that cost function. They're basically saying, this is the kind of thing I'm looking for. Go out and try to reach that state or come as close to it as you can. It's a highly guided kind of thing, even though the process of getting there may be more random or stochastic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I know that some of the work from William Dembski and Robert Marks has shown that when you do these search functions, without intelligence, they really perform no better than a random search. And it's whenever they do better than a random search, it's because there was sort of active information put there by an intelligence to help to guide the search and show it where to go. And so I think that this is an interesting area where your field of computer engineering and software design can contribute a lot to these questions about where new information comes from.
Yeah, in particular, if you're not looking for something, you're not going to use a genetic algorithm. And conversely, if you do decide to use one, it's because you're trying to tell it what to look for.
Yeah.
It just doesn't make sense any other way.
I love your example of going to Google and typing the I'm feeling lucky button. As sort of an analogous example, sometimes I've told people to go to Wikipedia, where there's actually a button. I don't know if you've seen this, but on the left side, if you go to the Wikipedia homepage, there's a random article button. And so you can click that. And if you're looking for information on, I don't know, jelly beans or something, keep clicking that until you find a page that has information on jelly beans. I mean, it's going to take you a long time to find it using a random search engine. Or you can type it into the search box. And my guess is you're going to get jelly bean information pretty quickly.
Pretty quickly, I would say. If you think about a genetic algorithm that doesn't have a cost function, it's not going to go anywhere. I mean, I guess the way you would think of that is the cost function simply accepts every candidate with equal probability. So you start with a random, well-distributed population of genes, and you evolve it to approach no state at all, because any mutation or whatever you consider acceptable, how are you going to get anywhere with that? So if the evolution camp can show that there really is a cost function like that somehow at the biological level, then maybe they can make a case. Without that, I don't see how they can.
Sure. To play the evolutionist advocate, I think that obviously they're going to say that natural selection is a cost function. It preserves structures that give some advantage to the organism. But there's a good rejoinder from the ID camp, which is, okay, well, what does the fitness function look like? Where exactly is this cost function capable of going? Natural selection will get stuck on these things called adaptive peaks, where if any change from that particular state will decrease your fitness function, then you're not going to move from that point. And so that's, I think, a major point that William Dembski and Robert Marks has said, look, if you have a nice sort of smooth fitness landscape, then maybe you can climb that. But once you get to that peak, if you have to go through a valley on every side to get to the next peak that you need to get to, you're never going to make it there. Whenever you have to go through these drops in fitness, then you're going to get stuck. You're not going to be able to get to some of these complex features. And if you don't mind me talking a little bit of shop here, there's a program, I don't know if you've seen it, it's called Avita. It was published in Nature probably about almost 10 years ago now. It's a genetic algorithm that's been widely touted as supposedly showing how new information can evolve using these genetic algorithms. Well, they did produce some interesting things in Avita, but if you read the Nature paper, there was one function where they were not able to produce it. For one of the more complex types of targets that they were trying to find, they did not give the program any selective advantage until it evolved the entire target function all at once. Sort of like irreducible complexity, where you don't get any advantage till you have all of the parts present all at once. And guess what happened? Avita was never able to evolve the target function when they set up the fitness function, so there was no advantage till you got there. No smooth fitness function. So, I mean, the fitness function, if it's not nice and smooth and flat like what Darwinian selection wants it to be, it will get stuck. So, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. The burden is on the Darwinian to show that the fitness function is such that it can evolve these structures.
You know, something else that's really interesting about these genetic algorithms is that depending on how you code them, the vast majority of your candidates along the way may be completely non-functional. So whether they represent a computer program or part of a circuit design or who knows what, some structural design, they might be completely not viable. So until you get close to your desired fitness, you're going to have stuff that just could not possibly survive. And the interesting thing in biology is that they're telling us that all this stuff evolved, that only the good things were retained. But it seems to me, just numerically, almost everything that we see in the fossil record should be a transitional form. Almost everything. And, you know, where are those things? And why is it that paleontologists are telling us a dog way back then is pretty much the same as a dog today? So every single one of them along the way has to be able to sustain life by itself or be real close to it long enough to reproduce mm-hmm. or somehow pass along its genetic information. And the majority of the things we see should not have been a dog or a horse. They should have been something in between, something along the branch in between those two points.
I think you raise an interesting point. When you've got so many non-functional possibilities that are out there, what are the odds of a random search function stumbling upon those functional sort of islands in a sea of non-functionality? And I agree. I think that's a real problem for evolutionary biology. This is turning into a really fun discussion, Dr. Steiner. I'd like to maybe turn the conversation in a little bit of a different direction. I know that you are a supporter of Discovery Institute, which we're real appreciative of that. You and lots of other folks that support Discovery are really what make it possible for us to do what we're doing. So if you don't mind me asking, why do you support Discovery Institute? Why do you feel that what we're doing is worthwhile?
Again, I saw The Privileged Planet and I was so impressed by that. I really think it's well done. As a, not quite a scientist, but at least an engineer, I found it fascinating. The universe is so complex and gorgeous, and that's true down at the subatomic level, and that's true up at the cosmic scale. Just seeing that information is always fun, for one, but I think you guys are one of the few groups that I know that does stuff of this quality. I could pass this along to anybody I know, whether they agree with me on evolution or not, and I wouldn't have to be in the slightest bit embarrassed by it, because it's just it's really good quality stuff.
Well, we appreciate that very much, Dr. Steiner. One last question I'd like to ask you. Obviously, you were a student once, slogging through your engineering classes. I didn't want to know how many years it took to get all of the degrees that you got with all of your computer and electrical engineering degrees. But what advice would you give to a student who maybe is thinking about how to pursue a career in electrical engineering, computer sciences? And let's assume, for the sake of this discussion, that the student is interested in intelligent design, maybe friendly to it, or is sort of thinking about these kinds of issues. What advice would you give to that student as they think through these issues and as they're going along in their studies?
First of all, science and engineering and math and all that stuff is fascinating. And to be honest, we don't have enough people in those fields. And in my field, I just came back from a conference and not everybody I know, but a whole lot of people that I know are hiring. In fact, I'm trying to look for two good people now. And it's a very specialized field, but we don't have enough of what we want. So for anybody out there who's interested in the general fields, go for it. It's really fun. Yeah, there's hard work for the studies, but you'll get through it and it's totally worth it. But what I would tell people is look at the data. Ask yourselves, do you really think that what you're being told is credible? Because science really ought to be objective. It's not about what everybody is telling you. It doesn't matter how shrill they get. It doesn't matter how often they tell you that something is fact. If the data doesn't back that up, you got to kind of toss it out. So my personal view about evolution, for instance, is that it's a decent scientific hypothesis, and it's an abysmal failure as a scientific theory.
Fair enough. We wish you the best in your work, Dr. Steiner. Thank you so much for coming on the show today and talking with us.
It's a pleasure being here.
And Dr. Steiner, I want to make it clear as we close, as you asked me to add, that your views are your own and are not those of the University of Southern California or of the Information Sciences Institute. I'm Casey Luskin with ID the Future. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2013. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.